Welcome to TWIL, the Week in Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on March 24th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis, and my co-host is...
Frank Pasquale, a law professor at the Francis King Carey School of Law in Baltimore, Maryland.
And we're very happy today to welcome Erin Fuse-Brown, who's a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law, where she teaches administrative law and health law finance and delivery. Our format is simple. Our health law topics tend to be more challenging. And we thought we'd start today, given that Erin is sort of the Steve Brill of health law academics and is a true expert on pricing, which always seems to be in the news. And it's a little difficult sometimes to figure out how pricing and price and cost kind of fit together. For example, we seem to have been talking about bending the healthcare cost curve forever. So, Erin, how is the pricing issue different from the cost issue? And does understanding that distinction help us with that pesky cost curve?
Thanks, Nick, and thanks, Frank. It's great to be here. You know, that's a great question. And I think a lot of times we get our terminology mixed up and, you know, we talk about healthcare prices, we talk about healthcare costs, we talk about health spending, and all of, you know, all of those things are interrelated. The way I think about it sort of is sort of how the phenomenon depends on where you're sitting. Healthcare costs, I think about those as the costs of doing business as a healthcare entity. So if you're, you know, a hospital, what is the cost of, you know, providing the services that you provide to your patients? What are the input costs? Price is the perspective that we, the consumer of healthcare, those who are patients or purchasers of healthcare, are often thinking about, because what is it going to, it's basically my healthcare costs. What is it going to cost me to go receive healthcare services? And that depends a lot on what price I'll be paying or my insurer will be paying for those services. So costs and price are often interrelated. And in terms of the overall healthcare spending, that's just, you know, what are we spending as a nation and as private individuals on healthcare? A combination of sort of the input costs and then the prices that get spit out as a result of that.
Yes, the cost issue is so interesting in terms of how we think about what percentage of income as well that any individual at any given time should, say, be paying for their health care and how that relates to the cost of the system overall. And I've been engaging a bit in the past couple of years with Allison Hoffman's work in looking at the overall out-of-pocket expenses that are expected under the ACA and in other areas. But what I find so interesting in your scholarship, or one of the many facets that I find so interesting, is you discuss how there are many people for whom, even though they ostensibly have out-of-pocket backstops that would, say, protect them from spending too much, there are other people who they or other folks end up getting really slammed by irrational hospital pricing or very high other pricing. And I was wondering if you could discuss sort of the dangers there and also whether there are any good legal solutions on the horizon for them.
Sure. Well, yeah, there are lots of ways. And it's one of the funny things. It's one of those areas that I picked this topic to research because, you know, I just find this stuff fascinating. But whenever I go on the road and I talk about healthcare prices and healthcare costs and healthcare bills, inevitably, you know, people come up to me who are not interested in health law at all afterwards and say, you know, the worst thing happened to me when I went to the hospital. I got this terrible bill. And so absolutely people, ordinary people, certainly vulnerable people, but just regular people who have insurance are starting to see sort of more and more out-of-pocket spending when it comes to their healthcare costs. And part of that is the trend toward, you know, more and more high deductibles, consumer-directed healthcare. You know, we all have skin in the game now, like it or not. So we're paying for a lot of our own healthcare services. But that's part of it. And part of it is also just that there are so many, the hospital bills that make up such a great deal of our healthcare spending in this country are just unbelievably complicated. They make no sense. They're completely irrational, and they And, you know, and they're written in these codes and jargon that no one can understand. And then their prices are so out of whack. You know, a $10,000 pill of Tylenol, you know, just is, it's the Stephen Brill phenomenon. People are flabbergasted and they don't know where to begin. It's much worse if you don't have a health insurance company in your corner, but it's not much better even if you do. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. You could find yourself out of network. That's a big reason. We're seeing a lot of networks narrowing. This is sort of spurred along by the Affordable Care Act, and it's also partly a phenomenon that was already underway. So we see lots of narrow networks. If you find yourself out of network, well, you're going to see a higher bill for your healthcare experience, and you also are going to see balance billing and other sort of nightmarish scenarios where you get these incredibly high bills for, you know, something that you thought was a simple trip to the ER might end up costing you tens of thousands of dollars.
So your position is that the irrationality of pricing is actually going to have more of an impact as the Affordable Care Act reforms take place, or at least some of them, in that more of us are going to be faced with these pricing issues that perhaps our insurance companies used to shield us from, essentially, because we didn't have to worry about that. I was also noting that I think the states that have Medicaid expansion, the hospitals in those states have noticed a $5 billion reduction in unpaid-for costs. So I guess the at one end of the scale, therefore, Medicaid expansion is stopping some of the implications of very high pricing being passed on to the uninsured. But on the other hand, it's having the impact of increasing the pricing dilemmas for those of us who were once immune from that.
Yeah, I think they're all, you know, there's sort of the hydraulic forces, you know, money flows to wherever it's going to flow in the system and whoever's willing to pay. Unfortunately, more and more the ordinary person is being left holding the bag on their own healthcare bills to a larger and larger degree. And I think what you're pointing out about uncompensated care falling for hospitals, yeah, that's absolutely great news for those people who, you know, who used to be uninsured, who were unable to pay their high hospital bills and would perhaps go bankrupt or would otherwise just be, you know, unable to pay. You know, hospitals are seeing a decline in that, especially in, like you said, in the Medicaid expansion states. To a lesser degree, even in the non-Medicaid expansion states, we're seeing that because more and more people are being insured. And so, you know, one temptation is to sort of, you know, congratulate ourselves and say, you know, job well done, Affordable Care Act reformed healthcare, people are getting covered, and, you know, our job is done. And the reality is that it's shifting. And what's happening is that more people are getting covered, but coverage is meaning less than it used to. Yes, we have sort of the essential health benefits and we have some new protections that are very important and very helpful, but there are still sort of gaps. There are still ways to find yourself holding an incredibly high hospital bill. And you're right, more and more people are finding themselves in that position, just as we see sort of an explosion of high deductible healthcare, as we see more people, you know, finding themselves with surprise medical bills. You know, providers are trying to find ways to eke a little bit more out of the patient in terms of financial remuneration.
Yes, I do think that's a critical issue. It reminds me of Charles Morris's book, The Surgeons, where, you know, he discussed there would be so many plans developed by healthcare technocrats to manipulate what type of cardiac care or cardiology care was being delivered. And he said essentially the staff of the cardiologist simply functioned as a shield that would try to manipulate, playing a game almost, against the efforts by technocrats to sort of create rational incentives, et cetera. One thing that I was wondering if you could expand on, just because I know we have a mixed audience and, you know, some are intimately aware of concepts like balance billing. Others may be less aware of them. I wonder if you could just describe what balance billing is and why it might be a good idea for states to follow, say, the Medicare lead and severely restrict or end it as a billing option.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things that's the fine print. One of the things I do with my students is I have them read the benefit booklet of all the Georgia State employees and try to pick a health plan. And one of the fine print items that we spend a lot of time talking about is balance billing, because nobody is aware that this is an issue until you get a balance bill in the mail. So yes, balance billing happens generally when you are out of network. And even if you have a PPO or a plan that provides some coverage for out of network services, what you're not protected from is the provider, the hospital, the physicians, from turning around and then billing you for the difference between what your insurance company paid them and what their gross charges are, sort of their full retail undiscounted rack rates that everyone agrees is sort of are these arbitrary rates, but they are very, very high. And so, you know, you may be faced with a balance bill of 30% to 40% of your total bill, and you didn't even realize that's what would happen when you went out of network. You realize you might pay more to go out of network, but you didn't realize you were going to get this balance bill. And it ends up being a significant financial burden for a lot of people. And sometimes the balance bill comes, you know, you were in the emergency room. You had no choice but to go out of network. Or you went to what you thought was an in-network hospital, but all the doctors who saw you weren't in your network, and so you get balance billed by them. So there are lots of ways that people can get sucked into this sort of financial nightmare of balance billing and other types of sort of surprise medical bills, extra medical bills that are really substantial without having any way to prevent them, stop them, or avoid them, which is where the state regulation comes in. There are lots of options for states, but for the most part, the model that we see a handful of states adopting is, you know, a prohibition on balance billing out-of-network patients entirely, basically saying not for any sort of emergency care, any medically necessary care. If you're an out-of-network provider, you can't balance bill a patient. You have to basically take what their insurance company pays you as, you know, the full amount.
That does sound like a very impressive solution to the problem in terms of being sure that the sort of gotcha pricing isn't an available outcome or doesn't become a widespread business method. Because, you know, as you state, and I think this was brought up in a pioneering way by Tim Jost's book on consumer-directed healthcare from Duke University Press. It's just the model of consumption and of informed consumption that lies behind so much of the consumer-directed healthcare movement just doesn't really match the lived experience of the individual who, you know, feels terrible and terrible enough to go to an ER. I'm also wondering if you might be able to discuss, I saw that you recently posted a paper on rate regulation, and if you might be able to discuss that as, say, a more ambitious alternative or agenda for states that are worried about these developments.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. And I think that the two go hand in hand. I think recently the big push has been for consumer-directed healthcare. We see that trend. It predated the Affordable Care Act, but the Affordable Care Act kind of took it and ran with it. That's the expansion of high deductibles, again, this notion of consumer skin in the game, price transparency, all of these efforts to try to get healthcare consumers and patients to act more like consumers and use market forces to control healthcare prices. And all of those efforts are extraordinarily popular from a political standpoint because, again, it's this sort of, you know, let's just use the market. That will achieve efficiency that way. Let's arm consumers with information and they will make the best choices for them. And I think you're right that, you know, Tim Jost, Mark Hall, several scholars have written very well about this notion that, you know, patients are not your typical consumer. Even though your hospital bill may be the most expensive bill you ever get in your life, you really are in no position to bargain or to be an informed consumer for most of your healthcare expenditures. If your child is, you know, needing emergency surgery, you're not going to sit there and ask the doctor, you know, is this the best place to have it or shall we go somewhere else? Do we really need this service? Can you do it cheaper? You know, you're just not going to bargain if you're at all under duress medically or if you're sick or you're, you know, concerned about the quality of the care that you're going to get. So, yeah, people really are not in a position to be good consumers when it comes to their own healthcare. And then that sort of leads us to, well, then, are these market models for getting prices under control really going to ever work when we have consumers who are limited in their ability to be good market participants, but also when we don't have any market to begin with? One of the sort of characteristics of our healthcare system is that it's an increasingly consolidated and concentrated marketplace. Just about the vast majority of all metropolitan areas, the hospital market is highly concentrated. There's almost no highly competitive hospital market left in the country. And as a result, we have, you know, this effort on the one hand to inject all of these competitive forces to bring healthcare prices under control, and no competition to speak of to you know, that you need choices in order for competition to have any effect on price whatsoever. And so, yeah, I've looked more recently at some of these and other sort of proposed solutions. How do we get our healthcare prices under control? And, you know, as popular as market forces are, they're just not going to be effective in the vast majority of places in this country. And instead, you know, really, healthcare systems are getting so big, they're becoming sort of these almost natural monopolies or utilities. We really ought to be regulating them sort of like utilities and say, you know, we're going to regulate price because the market can't do it. There's no competition left in these markets to wring out, you know, price improvements.
So Uwe Reinhardt sort of famously reminded us that most economically developed nations have health insurance coverage that pays physicians, hospitals, and so on sort of common fee schedules. It's kind of what you were talking about, thus sparing the insured the need to seek out lower price care, and so obviates the need for transparency. Assuming that we did have some kind of market operating, are we anywhere close to the kind of transparency side of this that we need to make it work?
You know, I'm not sort of an anti-price transparency person, but yes, I agree with you that we're not there yet. I mean, I think we absolutely need to think about improving transparency, but not just on price. We need more information than just what something's going to cost. We really need something like quality transparency as well. So when you go on Yelp and look for, you know, where you're going to have dinner, you look not just at, is this a $4 sign restaurant? You also look at how many stars they got, what's been the experience of other people who've dined there before. And so we really do need comprehensive quality transparency to go along with price transparency to make any sense of the data at all. Otherwise, people are just going to go to the higher price, you know, providers because they think, well, they must be more expensive for a reason. It must be because they're better. And in fact, that's not the case. But without any quality information, we can't make sense of the price information. So we certainly need the price information, but we need it to be paired with, you know, really robust, meaningful quality measures. And we also need to be able to tell when a person, you know, when you're shopping around, we need to be able to tell whether or not, you know, is this, again, in my network? Is this someone that I, you know, is this going to be meet my needs? Do I even need this service to begin with? So there's a lot more information than just sort of price. But absolutely, price transparency would be a helpful data point along the way.
So there was a very recent study of U.S. hospital websites where they concentrated just on a single surgical intervention. And they found vast discrepancy across these hospital websites about the information that was disclosed as to risks and benefits, or even sort of the more amorphous value. Are those the kinds of extra pieces that you need to push in with price in order to really have transparency?
Yeah, certainly things like value, but also, you know, to the extent it's really hard to measure quality and value. You know, if you are shopping around for a surgeon to do your, you know, your open heart surgery, you want someone who's done that procedure thousands of times. You'd like to know their error rate and how it compares to others in a similar area with a similar patient population. So, you know, those types of quality measures are very hard to capture. And so even though we're increasingly able to collect quality data, we're still far short of having great measures on all the metrics that we'd want in order to be able to shop appropriately on a sort of procedure-by-procedure basis.
Well, you know, I'm so glad that you all brought up the quality transparency issue, because here are two rival studies that I think really support your point of view, Aaron, and you know, Nick's concerns as well. So the first is something came out just in Health Affairs this month, March 2015, on confusion generated by four major hospital rating system. I think one by Consumer Reports, U.S. News, a couple of other ones. And the argument of the authors of the paper was that the methodology of these hospital rankings was so divergent that I think almost never did the same hospitals appear at the top of all four different rating systems, suggesting that the level of variability among them was so high that they it diminished the reliability there. So there's a problem of complexity and the difficulty. And I looked at some of the methodologies of these studies, and it is amazing the degree of if you think school rankings, university rankings are complex, the hospital rankings seem 10 times as complex, at least according to the stated methodology. But on the other side of it, there was also a study, and I'm going to try to post this on the show page, that had videos of bariatric surgeons. And essentially, they stated that almost any layman, upon watching a few 30-second videos of bariatric surgeons trying to do surgery, could recognize who was very good and skilled and who was not. And it's kind of amazing that this sort of Malcolm Gladwell-style thin slicing approach to assessing the quality of the surgical of the surgeon who was videoed, they actually said that the people's initial impressions were validated by, say, much more comprehensive assessments of error rates. So I just think it's such an exciting area to think about. How do we learn about judgments of quality and how to convey judgments of quality and essentially motivate a competition for higher quality, more error-free healthcare once we've conceded that competition price-wise just may not be available under standard market mechanisms.
So I think that issue of quality measurement and so on is also underlying our second topic for today. As we record this, the only thing people are talking about vis-a-vis healthcare in Washington is the sustainable growth rate fix that Congress is looking at. I think a Brookings report called it the ultimate Groundhog Day legislation. Every year we have to do it again, and the stakes rise each year because of the cumulative effect. I think it's now about 21% if they don't do something this year. So what is this? Is it something we should be concerned about? Is this a useful method of holding down cost, or is it sort of very old-fashioned, given that we're moving away from a fee-for-service model, which I think the SGR payment formula was really designed to sort of sit on top of?
Well, absolutely. I think this is, you know, the SGR, the Sustainable Growth Rate Mechanism. Again, just to sort of do some translation for those who aren't wonks glued to their C-SPAN and their, you know, Hill Watch. But, you know, the Sustainable Growth Rate is also known as the Doc Fix. And this has been around since 1997. The Balanced Budget Act was designed to tie our spending on Medicare physician services to the overall growth rate of the economy. You know, it seemed like a perfectly ordinary idea. We're spending too much in Medicare. It's growing too fast. Well, I know one way is to, you know, tie our physician payments in the Medicare program to overall GDP growth. And so by applying this SGR formula, ever since 2002, you get this, you know, perverse result where doctors get, you know, double-digit cuts in their payments. And so, of course, Congress has 17 times avoided this drastic cut and fixed it with little short-term patches that just get us from 1 month to the next or 1 year to the next. And here we are contemplating a permanent repeal of the sustainable growth rate methodology. And you're right, maybe it's sort of, you know, it's in some ways it's old news because the idea of paying doctors on a fee-for-service basis and moving them to a value-based payment model, one that uses alternate payment models to pay more for value and quality and less for numbers of procedures done, is an old concept now, one that has sort of got bipartisan support. Everyone is in agreement that that's a good thing. What we can't seem to agree upon in Congress is how to pay for it, because cutting the SGR adjustment, even though we seem to avoid it every year, costs a lot of money, because it really would result in less Medicare spending if we were to apply the SGR methodology as written. And so we have to come up with, because of PAYGO, the pay-as-you-go rule in Congress, we have to, whenever we approve an expenditure in the Congress, we need to find offsetting savings or cuts somewhere else. And coming up with $213 billion of savings is a very hard job for Congress to do.
So I think the Democrats are generally supporting the fix because it includes a reauthorization of CHIP for a couple of years. But as you say, the really tricky piece is the budget offset. That originally seemed to be primarily coming out of Medicare, or a large part was coming out of Medicare Part D reductions for wealthy seniors. But, and again, I stress that we're recording this on March 24th, there was an AP exclusive this morning suggesting that, in fact, there are quite large Medicaid cuts which are going to actually be part of the offset and maybe get the veto pen out, I suppose.
Yeah, I haven't seen I think just today the bill was announced that came out of the House, so I haven't seen, all the details. I only saw sort of the rumor mill version of what would be in the SGR bill. And that's right, there are some cuts, even though some of it was come out on the backs of sort of wealthier Medicare beneficiaries in terms of means testing their Part D and B and D premiums and sort of forcing first dollar coverage and Medigap provisions, Medigap policies to, convert to sort of a minimal deductible plan. These are things that are not insubstantial when you're talking to Medicare beneficiaries who live on fixed incomes. To the extent that then you dip into other types of programs like Medicaid, then certainly the Democrats are going to have a harder time swallowing the SGR proposal.
Could I just step back a bit, just from the current events here and the current debate? I mean, I think is fascinating, but I was also wondering, in terms of the big picture, and the wisdom of this policy, I, on one level, am sympathetic, and on another level, I'm a little more critical, and I just would love to hear Aaron's and Nick's views on my concerns, which are, on the sympathetic level, I get the idea, going back to 1997, that there was concern that healthcare spending was a bit out of control and that we wanted to gauge it, or at least chain it, like chain CPI, chaining it by constraining it to the level of growth of the economy as a whole. On the other hand, I wonder, in the long term, do we think that the U.S., the share of healthcare as a share of the GDP or the economy, needs to be lower than it is now? Are there conditions under which it could be higher than it is now? I'm just wondering what the long-term view is, because I imagine, if I had to put the position of, say, the AMA on our podcast, I imagine some doctors would say, hey, wait a second. If say finance or the military sector is growing faster than the overall rate of the economy, why can't we? Or is the idea perhaps suggested in the utility rate regulation model that Brill and others have put forward, that healthcare is different and that because of its unique ability to, say, gouge people for too high prices, that it needs to be under a special watch? So I know those are big issues, but I just would love to hear your thoughts on them, Aaron.
Yeah, well, I think that the idea behind the SGR, like you said, it sounds sort of good, right? I mean, the idea that we need to figure out sort of automatic ways to tie our own hands because we can't help ourselves. The way the Medicare program is written, if there's a, if there's a Medicare beneficiary who needs an expenditure, we spend it. And so Congress was trying to figure out a way to get healthcare spending in the form of Medicare spending under control. And, the good news is that for other reasons, the Medicare cost curve is coming down. It is being bent at the moment for what we believe is not just sort of short-term reasons, but also longer-term trends. The problem is that, yeah, you're right, there's still a healthcare cost control specter that we're not grappling with if we get rid of the SGR problem. And that is, how much spending is too much. And I think that we see a lot of the SGR debacle was sort of a good idea that when applied ended up being, you know, just too politically unpopular. The AMA is a very powerful lobby. Seniors, you know, didn't like it as well because they don't want their doctor to drop out of Medicare. And so it ends up being this political hot button issue that Congress has no choice but to avoid it every year. I think that, you know, as far as what level of spending is sort of the ideal amount, you know, I don't know. But we do see the ripple effects of this happening in other parts in the Affordable Care Act. Again, we haven't seen it come to effect. It's just theoretical at this point. But we see the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which was Congress's way to avoid the SGR problem in the future, which is let's give this power to an independent agency so we don't have to make this decision when Medicare spending exceeds certain thresholds, then this independent body will be in charge of cutting Medicare spending for us. And unless we override it with a, you know, 3/5 majority, then we can't, or a 2/3 majority, we can't essentially, you know, whatever the agency wants is what's going to happen. And so I think that we see Congress basically seeing its political limitations, that as much as we want to control healthcare spending really matters. It translates to real lives. It translates to, you know, grandma's benefits. And so people get very, very politically motivated to prevent any cuts in healthcare spending. So it's hard to ratchet or bend the cost curve on the backs of beneficiaries.
The opposite seems to be true in that we seem prepared to put additional payments in for things like value and quality as opposed to reining things in first. For example, I believe that the meaningful use penalties will be suspended or sunsetted rather if the SGR fix goes through, and those meaningful use dollars, the incentives, will be rolled into a broader quality improvement program, so actually suggesting we pay a little bit more. So I thought finally today we should talk about a somewhat related issue, because it does go to the amount of profit as well as revenue that is in the U.S. healthcare system. And a very interesting little development in California with Blue Cross Blue Shield losing its, I think, Aaron, it's its state tax exemption. Is that correct?
Yeah, Blue Shield of California, which actually in California is separate than Blue Cross, did just, you know, apparently lost its state tax exemption back in August, but the LA Times reported it this past week for the first time. And, you know, this was seen as a pretty significant occurrence because Blue Shield is one of the largest insurers in California. They've been exempt from state taxes since their inception in 1939. The Blues lost their federal tax exemption sort of en masse many years ago, but from a state tax standpoint, state income tax exemption is a very significant tax exemption for Blue Shield of California, I think in the billions of dollars or million, you know, that they will have to pay back if they're subject to income taxes at the state level.
So just as background, can you fill us in a little bit on the federal piece here? Because I know the Affordable Care Act changed some of the general requirements for nonprofits and how that works out.
Yeah, so the Affordable Care Act, a lot of the activity in the Affordable Care Act regarded new rules for tax-exempt hospitals, not exactly tax-exempt plans, health plans. But tax-exempt hospitals are, of course, subject to some additional requirements to earn their tax-exempt status. But this comes out of this general skepticism that's growing both at the federal level and now we see, obviously, at the state level, on whether or not these healthcare entities, whether they're hospitals or health plans, really are deserving of their, you know, billions of dollars of tax exemptions at the federal or state level. And in the case of Blue Shield of California, I think their reserves were, you know, so high in the $4 billion range, you know, was many times higher than would be required for, you know, solvency requirements. They were basically acting completely consistently with all the other competitors in the marketplace that are for profit, you know, paying their executives very rich compensation packages and the like. And so, the question came and was answered, you know, are you any different than a for-profit entity? And the answer, according to the Franchise Tax Board of California, was no.
And, you know, in terms of the background for cases like this, I believe that in the Hall Bobinski O'Rentlicher health law casebook, there's the description of the Utah Intermountain case. And I think there were also, I remember discussing with Kathleen Buzang over at Seton Hall, some interesting moves in Illinois to really rigorously re-examine the foundations of, say, the tax exemption. I remember back in a debate in 2008, Einar Elhag did a conference at Harvard Law School where I think Jill Horowitz was there and some other folks were there. I forget the name of the leading critic of nonprofit status for hospitals, but it was a really interesting discussion in terms of nonprofit and for-profit. And I'm just wondering, does the nonprofit form, is there evidence that that's a really important thing for hospitals to encourage them to, say, do more for the community? Or does it just sort of seem to be a relic? And do the states maybe seem to be leading in a direction that ultimately perhaps even the federal IRS might want to reconsider over time?
Yeah, it seems like that critique, which has been going on for, you know, a couple decades now, is really on point, and it still has a great deal of traction, especially at the federal level with Chuck Grassley. So long as Chuck Grassley has a position in the Senate, then I think we will have scrutiny into the tax exempt status of hospitals and whether they are earning their tax exemption. But yeah, absolutely. I think Jill Horowitz did some great research on some of the benefits, you know, in terms of service lines that are not profitable that tax exempt hospitals tend to provide more. But there is a real live debate about the value of tax exemption and whether or not we really ought to have tax exemption for hospitals. For the moment, we seem to have settled, at least the federal government has settled on a policy of simply trying to ask for more transparency. Again, transparency is a theme here. To just ask hospitals to provide more information, to do a community health needs assessment, to make their financial assistance policies more widely available, and to, you know, to some degree, to refrain from overbilling their uninsured or their financially needy patients, billing them full gross charges was a common practice even recently. And so to avoid that, rather than billing full gross charges, you can only bill the amounts you would generally bill to an insured patient. So there are some improvements that we see in terms of the rigor that hospitals and to some degree now we're seeing something similar happen with the health plans have to earn their tax-exempt status. I don't know if there's a widespread abandonment of the tax-exempt form for these entities, but I think there is increasing scrutiny that basically, look, these hospitals are suing their patients. They're doing these things that don't seem very charitable. Why are they getting the benefit of all of these very, very valuable tax exemptions?
So, Aaron, as our time draws short, help us out sort of with this this overall space that you're such an expert in, from cost to price to these sort of IRS rules and everything that we've been discussing with nonprofits and so on. For us less skilled in this area, what should we be keeping an eye on? What are the things that you're watching out for over the next couple of years that we should be paying attention to?
Well, one thing that I'm concerned about is, again, this notion that the ordinary insured person is increasingly financially vulnerable, that we haven't slayed that pricing beast, that we haven't slayed the healthcare cost problem for ordinary Americans, even as we cover more people, because we're just, you know, we're finding ways to charge them bit by bit more and more. We're shifting a lot of those costs from employers and from providers and from insurers to the individual. So that's one trend that I'm following, and that I think, you know, unfortunately, we don't have any really good legal solutions for yet. And it's an emerging problem that I think we'll have to come up with some interesting solutions for. How do we manage this shifting of risk, financial risk and otherwise, from these large, deep-pocketed entities to individuals who really don't have a lot of financial backstop or wherewithal to absorb this risk? So that's one thing I'm watching. And in general, I think there's a lot of good work being done at the state level in terms of things like balanced billing bans on fair pricing laws. There's a lot of work being done there that I think would be great models to watch and to see if we would want to expand those at the federal level.
Thank you. And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very special thank you to Erin.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And you can find Erin on Twitter at FUSEBROWN. We post our show notes at TWIHL, that's TWIHL.com. You can contact me on Twitter at NICOLASTERRY, that's at Nicholas Terry. And Frank, where can you be found?
I'm at Twitter at Frank Pasquale and also at HealthPI.
Thank you for joining us and have a legally interesting but healthy week.